You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. Melanie Benjamin is here. Her latest novel, The Swans of Fifth Avenue, is a novelized version of Truman Capote and the women of New York's high society of the 60s, his swans. Maybe, though, it's also a novel of the end of Truman Capote. Melanie, welcome.
Hello. Nice to be here.
How about that? Is it about the swans or is it about Truman Capote's demise?
It's about both. It's about the end of an era, I think, for a lot of people.
Let's start with the swans.
Sure.
Generally, who were they?
They were, I think of them as the first Real Housewives of New York in a way, but in a different era. They were led by Babe Paley, the wife of CBS founder William S. Paley. And they were the beautiful, glamorous socialites of Manhattan in the 50s and 60s. And Truman Capote, and they met, and it was love at first sight for a very long time.
Slim Keith was another of the
Slim
swans.
Slim Keith, Gloria Guinness, CZ Guest.
Right.
Yeah.
Who's Slim Keith?
She was married to the director Howard Hawks. That was her first husband.
So she was, right, she's the one who sort of was the basis for
Lauren Bacall.
The Lauren Bacall persona.
Yes, yes. She discovered Lauren Bacall modeling in the pages of Harper's Bazaar and told her husband that he should discover her. And he did. And he basically modeled her entire look, her dialogue, her clothing, everything on his wife,
on
Slim.
On Slim Keith. Mm-hmm. And so these women are influential, but they really get their power in many ways from their husbands. I mean, I think you said in an interview that it's important for today's readers to know that these women lived and ascended in a time when they were really dependent on their husbands for security and for their standing.
Right. I mean, it is a different era. These women were born in the 1910s, basically, the teens of the early century. And in order to escape, whether it was poverty, whether maybe worse, sometimes the only option available, especially if you wanted a certain amount of financial security, was to marry and marry well.
And they are very frank in the fact that they're doing that. Mm-hmm. And that's what they were. Babe Paley was raised by her mother. She of three sisters, raised to catch a good, wealthy husband.
Right. And it's sad in a way. I mean, it's on one level, we don't want to think that these people had problems. If they have private yachts, we don't want to think that their lives weren't perfect. On the other, there's a price you pay. And particularly if you had other ambitions, perhaps, that you weren't allowed to channel into anything other than the perfection of your life.
So these women will dress for lunch, and they will dress to the finest, and they will go to the finest restaurants. And then sitting next to them, more often than not, or often anyway, is this young rising star, Truman Capote.
Right.
What did they see in him?
Well, in 1955, Truman was very different from the end of life Truman we remember. He was gorgeous. He was very young. He was a literary wunderkind of New York, a rising literary star. And he loved beauty. He loved wealth. He appreciated these women, what they did with their clothing, with their jewelry. He appreciated them as the works of art that they were in ways that their husbands never did.
Right.
And so initially, he was just the flavor of the month. The new find that everybody wanted to have on their dinner tables. But he fulfilled a different role. He was their best friend. He wasn't threatening. The husbands allowed it because he wasn't threatening. He wasn't going to sleep with their wives. But he became their best girlfriend.
And so if we talk about the women living in a time when they had to rely on their husbands for security and for standing, it seemed like he did that in a way with the swans. Like, he depended on them, too, in some sort of perverse way.
Well, he did. I mean, he loved the high life. He was frank about it. He loved, champagne for lunch and breakfast at Tiffany's. I mean, he wrote it. But he didn't have the means for that financially, not then. And so he was dependent. He was the guest always. And I think that in the 60s, when he became financially secure after In Cold Blood, he wanted to kind of turn the tables a little bit. That may have led to, I think, some of his actions later on.
He wanted to flex his muscle.
Right. He didn't want to always be beholden.
And that's when he throws this black and white ball.
In 1966.
My favorite part of the book. Was that your favorite part?
Yes. Everyone says that. It was the most fun to write. It really was.
Maybe we see Mia Farrow and Frank Sinatra stop by. We see all of these people. Rudolf Nureyev, but he's planning this black and white ball. And, he was the one who said, that he's going to make 500 great friends and 1,500 enemies.
Which he did.
Yes. Right? And he did that spitefully, right?
He did. He printed the guest list so that those who said they had been invited but unfortunately had to be out of town, well, their cover was blown. Everyone knew who was invited and who was not. It really was the end of an era, the culmination of this world of beauty and glamour and his fame after In Cold Blood. And I think everything went downhill from there.
It's interesting. Beauty and glamour and really ugly spite. I mean, it seemed spiteful in his part.
It was.
Bitchy.
It was a little bitchy. Truman very much wanted to be the star of everything, and he wanted to flex his power. And this, again, for the first time, he had the power. He had the financial wherewithal to really pick and choose. And, you know, he was just kind of a puppet master, I think, sometimes in a way. He saw himself as that. And in this particular instance, he was the ultimate puppet master for New York society.
It's interesting the way you write it. Maybe you meant it this way, but it's like that is the height of his ascension.
It is.
He writes Cold Blood. In Cold Blood, he throws this party, and then it starts to slide.
It does.
Because he can't write anything next.
Right. After In Cold Blood, which was an enormous success and quite deservedly so, a very, you know, an amazing literary book, he has a horrible case of just this enormous writer's block. What do I do next? How do I follow this up? I also think for a while he just very much got his head turned by the fame,
right.
You know, really enjoyed the fruits of his labor in a way. And I think this desperation, though, is what caused him to write this short story.
I don't know if we've said, and I want to make the point that Babe Paley was his close, that he was closest to Babe Paley.
Yes.
They were truly lovers in every way, but the physical way.
Right. An unconventional
intimate,
love
completely
affair.
Intimate.
Completely of the soul, of the heart, of the mind. They were both very wounded people, damaged by their mothers in different ways, who tried to hide the wounds with a fabulous exterior, but with each other, they didn't try to hide the wounds.
You mentioned the short story, the La Côte Basque, 1965.
Yes.
How did I do on my pronunciation?
Very good. I think that's exactly the way I pronounce it.
we'll stick with it then. It's been called maybe among the meanest short stories in American
literary
history.
It's horrible. I mean, it's you read it, you need to take a shower.
Yeah.
But this is what brought the downfall of the whole piece. It's what caused Truman to become a bitter, alcoholic, campy figure. It hastened Babe's death. It caused a suicide. He basically wrote a short story in which he betrayed all their secrets and all their confidences that these women had spent 20 years telling
him. So he couldn't, fiction was lost to him.
He
couldn't come up with it. And so he writes this sort of veiled fiction. But really, it's a tell-all on the people upon whom he depended.
He kept telling people he was being the Marcel Proust of New York society. He was going to write this amazing, you know, Proustian kind of epic about society. It was gossip. It was gossip. And, you know, Capote famously said all literature is gossip. Yeah. And in this case, he really meant it literally.
It never came out fully as a book. The story was published in Esquire.
Yeah, in 1975, this short story was published in Esquire.
Book editor said, don't do it.
I don't think his book editor said it, but many, many people in his life said, don't do it. And he said, they won't recognize themselves. But they did. He didn't take a lot of pain to disguise them very well.
Did he know?
The book is my answer as to why he did this. That's the one thing I'm asked all the time. Why do you think Truman did this? It's a complicated answer. And who betrayed whom in the end?
You think, I think, from what I've read, you know, Babe Paley, as she's dying, says at one point, she said, you know, we let Truman Capote down because he believed in us and he loved us and he was asking for unconditional love. This short story was the test of it. And these swans, who never spoke to him again, she says, we let him down.
I think that's one answer.
Yeah, that's your answer.
I want to show that it's a complex situation. And just to say he was spiteful isn't the easy answer. I think Truman is a very complex, many-sided person, as well as these amazing swans. They're not just beautiful women. They were all very wounded, complex, real people beneath the designer gowns. And that's what I wanted to show.
Well, the name of the book is The Swans of Fifth Avenue. So, I mean, are you a niche writer? You take famous women and you write fictionalized versions of those, or are you someone who's just riding an incredible wave?
I think so.
I mean, The Aviator's Wife. Right. My first book of yours that I read was The Autobiography of Mrs. Tom Thumb, which I still think about often.
I love that book. That's my favorite until this one.
Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
Not The Aviator's Wife so much.
That was a harder book for me to write, but it certainly was my biggest success, and you know, so far until this one, we'll see. But I think I am very inspired by other people's stories, not my own. I'm very drawn to what we don't know about famous people. I like to imagine what goes on when the curtains are closed.
So here's Truman Capote. It just occurs to me, writing this novelized version, you know what's coming.
Yeah, I do.
Very famous people. And wait a second.
Here I'm doing the same thing. Yeah. I know.
And
it's
you
so
are
meta.
writing about their dirty laundry. Literally.
I am, but I'm not the first person to air it. That's the difference. He was the one who aired it first, not me. And since he did it, there have been many, you know, biographies, Vanity Fair revisits
this. You're not revealing
this.
Anything.
I am not revealing anything that isn't already fairly well known. What I'm trying to do is put the human side to it, to get it past the bitchy gossip side and really trying to put the heart into it and the soul and the vulnerability and the tragedy and the heartbreak, all of it.
You said one time that you have no fear that you always will have ideas and words.
Yeah, I never worry about running out of words or stories.
And it's what did Truman Capote in.
It did. He, you know, if you look at his career, up until In Cold Blood, he was very autobiographical in what he wrote, I think. His first novel, Other Voices, Other Rooms, is very autobiographical. A Christmas Memory, all that is very much based on his childhood in different ways. Breakfast at Tiffany's, I think, is based on his own life in New York in a lot of ways. Then he writes In Cold Blood, which is kind of a story that fell in his lap.
Mm-hmm.
Kudos to him to have the literary chops to make it, you know, what it is. But then after that, I do think he ran out of his own stories. That's when he started borrowing his friends. So I do think a big part of the book is who owns our stories.
Tell me more about that.
Well, we have stories we tell ourselves. We have the stories we tell other people. We have the stories we tell other people about ourselves. Who owns these stories?
And that's what this book is
about. I think that's what the book is about.
You know, I also read that you had a completed book between... Was it Mrs. Tom Thumb and The Aviator's Wife, or The Aviator's Wife in this one?
Since The Aviator's Wife was turned in, I've written three books, and one was published, The Swans of Fifth Avenue. The other two will not be published. I decided I couldn't make them work.
Two books?
Yeah.
How far along were you?
All done. Done in the editing process.
And there's nothing salvageable there?
No. I don't think so. I'm not interested. I'm more interested in what lies ahead, not as what is in the past.
Right.
There are other stories I want to tell. Once you have a success, like I did with The Aviator's Wife, you have a lot more people involved in your career. A lot of people suggesting things you might want to explore. You do want to satisfy your readers, but you also want to push yourself as a writer. Sometimes it's hard to find the balance between those two, and I think I erred a little too much in what might be expected of me.
Rather than what you might expect of your...
Yes, well, rather than what I was actually passionate about. Swans hit that sweet spot. I was passionate about it. I also felt that it would satisfy the readers who enjoyed Aviator's Wife.
What you're saying is you struggled over who owned your stories.
Yeah, I did. Or who I was telling them to.
Right. Well, I'd like to read them.
No. I've told my sons who will manage my literary estate. Unlike Harper Lee, I don't want anything published that wasn't published
maybe
in my lifetime.
Maybe Harper Lee didn't either.
Maybe.
Melanie there's a story.
Yeah, I know.
Melanie Benjamin, the name of the book, The Swans of Fifth Avenue. You know, we have corresponded for years, and it's just nice to finally meet you
know
in person.
It is.
It's an odd universe how we can do that.
I know.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. I hope you'll follow me on Twitter @Steve Bertrand and on Facebook @Steve Bertrand on Books. Thanks, Melanie.
Thank you, Steve.